Well, good morning and welcome to the Green Party pre-budget update and briefing. The purpose of the briefing today is to outline the Green Party's analysis and critique of the government's economic and fiscal strategy. It's to release a report we commissioned from Burl looking at the long-term fiscal implications of the proposed asset sale program, and that's to talk about some of the Green Party proposals for alternatives for the budget on Thursday. Now, the sale of state-owned asset companies, or the power companies, is, if you like, the signature policy of this government, and yet there's been surprisingly little done about the long-term fiscal and economic implications of the proposed asset sale program. And for this reason, we commissioned Burl to do some work looking at those long-term fiscal and also economic implications, and we'll be launching that report later. The report's called Asset Sales, the Government Accounts and the New Zealand Economy, and the chief author is Dr. Ganesh Nana, who's the chief economist from Burl, and Ganesh will be speaking after me, and we'll take there'll be time at the end for questions for both of us. So, just try not to knock anyone's things. So looking at the, I've just got a slideshow. I like slideshows. And so what I'm going to cover is do a bit of an outline looking at, starting with the economic rebalancing, some analysis of how economic rebalancing is going, looking at some of the fiscal choices that the government's made and the impact on the budget of those fiscal choices, looking at the key findings from the Burl report. Ganesh will elaborate later. But looking at some of the key findings of the asset sale program in terms of the fiscal position, and then looking at some of the alternatives that the Greens have been proposing around smart green economic alternatives. So let's just start with economic rebalancing. Now, when Bill English took over as Minister of Finance, he made, I thought, some very good analysis, some good analysis and some good comments about the challenges facing the New Zealand economy. After 9 years of Labor, we had very high private sector external debt, and that was a big problem, and we had a very large current account deficit. And so he said we needed to rebalance the economy, and we agree with him about that analysis. It is critical to rebalance the New Zealand economy. But when you start to look at what's happened, and I think after 3.5 years we've got the right now to make some judgment calls about how successful or not National have been in rebalancing the economy, the outcomes aren't that great. Even the ANZ chief economist, Cameron Bagri, has come to the conclusion that, in fact, what we're seeing at the moment isn't export-led growth. What we're looking at is a 4% current account deficit. That's an $8 billion current account deficit at a time of record commodity export prices. So even when we've had record prices for commodity exports, we're still running a 4% current account deficit. And that's a huge problem for the New Zealand economy. One of the key indicators, if you like, of the rebalancing or not of the New Zealand economy is the current account deficit. And as we can see, the solid line is the actuals, where we're at a 4% current account deficit. The dotted line is the projections. And as you can see, we're projected by Treasury for our current account deficit to go down to 6.7%, or rather increase to 6.7% of GDP. So based on the government's own projections, you would have to say that economic rebalancing is not working. The government's proposals so far have not led to the kind of rebalancing that we need. And one of the parts of that would be if the export sector was doing well, but we know from the business operations survey that was released a month or so ago that the proportion of New Zealand businesses that are exporting is hardly changing. It's pretty much a flat line. And when we look at our net international investment position, this is from the pre-election economic and fiscal update done by Treasury, we can see that the net international investment position is getting worse and is projected to get worse. So this would have to be one of the key criteria on which we judge the government's performance. And on their own materials released just before the election, the position is getting worse, it's not getting better, which is, of course, exactly what you'd expect with a growing current account deficit. And part of that, I mean, just to look at one sector that I think is very illustrative of what's going on is the manufacturing sector. For the 3 calendar years of this government, manufacturing has declined in each of those years. Even in the third year, when The GDP as a whole grew marginally. The manufacturing sector still declined. Now, manufacturing is about 20% of our merchandise trade exports. It's a critical sector if we want our economy to rebalance. We can't just rely on selling dairy products to the world. We also need elaborately transformed manufacturers. It has to be a critical part of it. And what we're seeing on these figures is that the manufacturing sector is still in trouble. So that's looking at economic rebalancing. And I think that there's a very strong case to be made when you look at current account deficit, you look at the export sector, when you look at the net international investment position, that economic rebalancing is not happening. And that was one of the government's criteria that it set for itself. The second area I want to touch on, of course, relates very much to the budget, which is about the fiscal position of the government. And what the argument I want to make is that the fiscal position of the government is, to a large degree, but not entirely, to a large degree, a result of some very poor fiscal decisions that they've made. The first one, of course, has had a lot of traction lately, which is about the 2010 tax switch. So the government at the time claimed that it would be broadly fiscally neutral. We've looked at the numbers around that, and we would argue that, in fact, over the 18 months since it's come into play that we have figures for, you're looking about a $2 billion deficit. Now, the government has challenged these figures and said that they're not accurate, but when we've asked the government to release any evidence around that, they failed to do so. We've put our numbers out there, we've put our analysis out there, but so far the government has failed to produce any evidence to show that the tax switch was actually fiscally neutral. And our figures show that, in fact, it was about a $2 billion deficit in 18 months. Again, when you look at the earthquakes, so the government, rightly said, the earthquakes have been a significant pressure on the government's fiscal position. We agree with that. The question is, what do you do about it? So we proposed an earthquake levy that would raise about $1 billion a year. The government basically is going to borrowing. They floated this idea of the earthquake Kiwi bonds in order to raise low-interest loans, effectively 2% loans. They've raised about $26 million so far, which is essentially nothing to pay for the rebuild. We're talking a $5.5 billion cost on the government accounts. If the earthquake levy had been in place, we would have raised $1 billion by now. And we would pay the $5.5 billion in about 5.5 years. And then on the spending side, the government's making a series of poor quality spending decisions. Now, obviously, when you look at the roads of national significance, this is a $14 billion project over a decade. That puts enormous pressure on the government's fiscal position. But it does more than that. Aside from putting pressure on the fiscal position, it creates an obstacle to rebalancing. We spent $8 billion importing oil last year, and that is a huge pressure on the external accounts for New Zealand. What the roads of national significance do is lock in oil dependency. When, at a time when the IMF is predicting that we will see a doubling in oil prices over a decade, the government is spending $14 billion to lock in oil dependence. This will be a tremendous drag on the economic balance of our economy because we have to pay for all that oil import that we import, as well as a huge fiscal pressure on the government's books. And then, of course, there's the ETS subsidies, $1.7 billion thereabouts over 3 years. Again, this puts enormous pressure on the fiscal position of the government, but it also has economic implications. One of the biggest studies that was done looking at the impact of carbon prices on economies was the Australian Federal Government, the Treasury. And what the Treasury in Australia, when they analysed carbon prices, the conclusion they came to is that the longer you leave it, the bigger the economic costs. You're actually better to have the price on carbon up front because then you can get the adjustments and you also attract investment because you're one of the early movers. And so one of the conclusions from those kind of studies is actually in terms of economic rebalancing, you're better to introduce a carbon price early rather than protect a part of the economy behind a subsidy wall, which is what we're currently doing in New Zealand. We have a subsidy wall in front of the agricultural sector so that the taxpayer covers the cost of the emissions coming out of that sector. We subsidise it instead of the price running through and producing the kind of adjustments that we need. So that's looking, if we look at some of the fiscal choices of the government, we can see that on the revenue side, they've made some poor fiscal choices. On the spending side, they've made some poor fiscal choices. So effectively, they put the budget into a hole, and now New Zealanders are having to pay for their mistakes in terms of whether it's an increase in prescription charges, whether it's larger class sizes, less affordable housing. The poor decisions of the government on the budget put it into a hole, and ordinary New Zealanders have to pay the price. But there are a few decisions that are as poor as the decision that they're proposing to make around asset sales. And now I just want to take a few quotes from the Burr report around the fiscal impact and economic impact of asset sales. first thing is that basically the asset sale program will leave the government accounts worse off. That's both in terms of government debt, in terms of the debt ratio, debt to assets, whether it's net worth or total assets. So the decision to go down this path of the asset sale program, if National goes ahead with this program, if they're able to, will result in the government works books being permanently worse off. I think that's a very important fact that New Zealanders need to understand about what the government's proposing with their asset sale program. But it's not just about the fiscal position of the government, it's also about economic rebalancing. If we want to rebalance the economy, we want less money going overseas. Inevitably, some of these shares will go overseas. The government argues about how many of the shares will go overseas, but some of them will. That will add permanently to the imbalance in the New Zealand economy as some of those dividends flow overseas. It will add to the external deficit, and it will add to the external debt. And from an economic perspective, clearly it's unwise to go down a path when the New Zealand economy is so exposed in terms of its external deficit and debt problem. It's so exposed now, to adopt a policy that will make us more exposed is extremely unwise. These are the conclusions from the Bill Report. And the government's financial situation cannot be used as a justification for partial asset sales, because, of course, it makes the government's financial situation worse, not better, to go down the asset sale path. So when you think about it, the government's proposing these asset sales, they will make the government books worse off, they will make our economy worse off if we go down this path of selling our assets. It's a completely reckless decision. Okay, so finally, I just want to touch on some of the smart green economic alternatives. Now, obviously, the Greens talked a lot about this in the election campaign, but it's partly about looking at what the opportunities are. So we need to think about what the opportunities are for New Zealand, and we need to back ourselves to take advantage of those opportunities. Now, of course, this is a quote from the New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, which is a government agency. So even the government's own agency is talking about the opportunities that are available to New Zealand, particularly in the geothermal sector. Because what's happening is that globally, clean energy is growing quite rapidly. Now, obviously, we're not experts on every part of clean energy, but one part that we are leaders on is geothermal. Geothermal is growing. Mighty River Power has expertise in this area, and you know, tragically, it is targeted for the first round of privatisation. So we, the Greens, believe we should use Mighty River Power and the other state-owned enterprises as a base, as an export base for New Zealand, which we can build on, rather than selling them off. The risk if you sell them off is that the headquarters move overseas, the research and development moves overseas, and New Zealand just becomes a profit centre for a multinational. It's much more important that we keep them here and that they can partner with private sector entrepreneurs and partners rather than the whole thing ending up in overseas ownership. Now, likewise, Pure Advantage, that, you know, they're talking about a $6 trillion per year worldwide market. Now, green growth is growing internationally. It is a huge opportunity for New Zealand. Now, whether Pure Advantage is a group of leading New Zealand business people, Stephen Tindall, many others. Now, obviously, you know, you could put a large number in here, and nobody can be exactly sure how large this number is, but we know that the global market for green technology is growing very rapidly and is enormous. So I like to think that we have, it is a triangle of opportunity. So one way to think about it, right? And so there are opportunities for our country, which both have positive effects in terms of fiscal resilience, because we do need to improve the fiscal resilience of the New Zealand government. It has opportunities in terms of economic rebalancing, because we do need to rebalance the New Zealand economy to deal with the imbalances that we currently have. And I would argue that there's a nice relationship there with smart green economics, that they go together in a really positive way. It is a very... In terms of the relationship between the three, there are real positive relationships between them. Now, whether you look at capital gains tax, which is something obviously we've been promoting for a while, which has the advantage of, in terms of rebalancing, it drives capital into the productive sector. In terms of fiscal resilience, it has, in the long term, it has very positive effects on the government books. It doesn't raise a lot of money in the short term, but it does over the medium term. And in terms of smart green economics, it means that there's capital available for the investments we need to make in the green economy, which is the growing sector internationally. And the same applies to a series of initiatives here, whether it's transport spending, as I talked about earlier, improves our external accounts, good for the environment, good for the government's books, whether it's looking at the price of water, So that we drive efficiencies in the primary sector around the price of water, whether it's the home insulation scheme, which will have great fiscal effects because it reduces pressure on the health budget, boosting R&D, New Zealand's way behind on R&D compared to our OECD partners, whether it's higher standards for fresh water to protect our clean and green brand, which is fundamental to our export sector, whether it's mining royalties, where we have low mining royalties and we don't have a fund like Norway does, whether it's having a real price on carbon, so we get the efficiencies we need through the economy, whether it's a public option for KiwiSaver, so that we have a low-cost option for people so that they can save for the future, whether, as I was talking earlier, it's about supercharging our state-owned energy companies so that they're an export base for us, or whether it's investing in children, which is fundamental to our future. We need to invest in those children so that they don't become a huge cost in the future, but also so they make a great contribution to the future of our economy. Whether it's any of those things, I think that you can see that New Zealand does have great opportunities where we can improve our fiscal resilience, do economic rebalancing, and embrace the smart green economy. Those are the positive options. And in terms of what I've talked about today, I've tried to identify what I think are the results. If you look at economic rebalancing, the National Party government, it hasn't led to economic rebalancing after 3.5 years. When you look at the fiscal decisions that this government's made, both on the revenue side and on the spending side, I think you can argue that they've made some very poor fiscal decisions which have put the budget into a big hole. Whether you look at the economic and fiscal impacts of the privatisation program, and Ganesh will talk about more of that in a second, or whether you look at the smart green economic opportunities, which we're missing out on because the government hasn't grasped it. I think there are real alternatives to what the government's proposing on Thursday. I think we shouldn't be caught up in their rhetoric around there are no alternatives. There are good alternatives. We've put out some of them here. There are many others. And I think that we should challenge the government around both their fiscal arguments and their economic arguments. And what we need to do as a country is embrace those smart green opportunities. So I'm going to leave it there, and I'll hand over to Ganesh to talk specifically about his report and his findings in that report.
Kia ora tata. We were asked by the Green Party to have a look at the government's asset sale program and look at what impacts it would have on the government's accounts, and then also looking a little bit longer term on the wider economy as well. And as Dr. Norman said in his presentation, the guts of our report is that as currently structured, given the options that the government has put in front of the people of New Zealand, you cannot use the government's finances as a justification for going down the route of selling assets to fund infrastructure programs. That option leads us, given some varying, even with the best of assumptions, still leaves the government's accounts permanently worse off. Even more importantly, from my perspective as an economist, more interested in the wider economy and the prosperity of New Zealand, it leaves our greatest single vulnerability, which is our external debt, it leaves that in a potentially worse situation as well. So those are the two key things that I'd like to talk about, or that I'd like to be taken out of the report. I think one of the important things that we do need to get out there, and it's a source of frustration for me, and it's not helped by the commentary out there, this confusion between the government's accounts and the external accounts. It's important that we understand, if we are going to make the right choices, that we understand the difference between the government's deficit and the external deficit, and more importantly, the government's debt and the external debt. Put simply, the government's debt is us lending between the family, domestically, if we're lucky. So it could be good or it could be bad, depends what we do the borrowing for. External debt is just plain bad. External debt is going to the loan shark. So we've got to worry more importantly about what's happening to external debt, you can call it the net international liabilities, or by implication what's happening to our external deficit, which is the current account deficit. Those are the important things that should be staring us in the face. What happens to the government's debt and the government's deficit may be fine and may be turned around by 2014-15, But as was shown in the previous presentation, the government's own treasury forecasts still have external accounts getting even worse over that same period. Spend a bit of time whether we do this with real numbers and try and argue with real numbers, or we try and set up some hypotheticals. Given the time constraints on us, we decided to do some hypotheticals, but they're not too far distant to the real numbers. But we wanted to make it as simple as possible, because a lot of this argument is getting bogged down in the technicalities. The slide in front of you is as simple as I can put it. The difference between the deficit and the debt is important, and the difference in terms of what the government is doing with asset sales. The government is not, even though some are under the impression that they are, selling assets to pay off the debt. That is not the choice that they have put in front of us. They have, as far as I'm aware, not put that up as a option or as a justification, so we need to throw that out the water. What the government is doing is selling some assets and replacing them with other assets. And all that does is change the balance of the assets in that bottom left corner in terms of government assets, and the arrow then makes an implication for government income. That has implications on the deficit and potentially on the government's deficit, and therefore potentially on government's debt. There is no direct relationship between the government selling assets and paying off the government debt. That hasn't been put in front of the people, and that argument should not be continued, and it should be blown out of the water. We need to understand why the government is selling debt. And the justification is not that it's paying off debt, selling assets. The justification is not that it's paying off debt. The justification is that it's rebalancing the asset side of its balance sheet. So we did some explorations around some hypothetical accounts. We explored the government scenario that's been put in front of us, is that we sell some assets to build some new assets. The new assets, whether they be schools or broadband, school buildings or hospitals or broadband or roads, and selling some assets to fund that. Another alternative that Bill has thought up is, yes, we want to rebuild our asset base in terms of whether it be school buildings or roads or broadband, but let's fund that perhaps through some borrowing from the domestic private sector. What does that do to the government's accounts? And then we had a look at the bar. We needed to compare that in terms of a baseline. And the pictures are in the document and in the slides that I'll go through. The assumptions are critical, and as in any modelling, in any economic analysis, there are always critical assumptions. The three critical assumptions are, what is the cost of borrowing? What is the income that you get from the assets? And then the last one is, if you're replacing or you're selling off some assets and replacing them with new assets, how long do you have to wait for the income to come from those new assets? That's if you're looking at it from a purely government perspective, from the financial accounts. So those are the three assumptions. We assume, for argument's sake, but I think they're close to reality, we assume that the cost of borrowing is less than the yield from the assets that we are selling off, and we also assume that it is less than the yield from the assets that we are now building. But we do assume that there is a delay in getting the return from the new assets. The return from the new assets, okay, it won't be dividend yield if we're talking about school buildings or roads, but it will be through an increased economy, through increased growth, and so therefore through increased revenue coming through the government's tax coffers. That's the assumption. Well, we have to get some return on those new assets. The picture there, the black bars are the baseline, so we assume nothing else changes. Okay, just to keep things simple, we assume nothing else changes, and we have a black bar where the government's deficit is forever in deficit, and that's obviously not sustainable, but for argument's sake, we'll leave that there. The blue bar is what happens if the government sells some assets and replaces them with new infrastructure, new school buildings, new roading or whatever. In the short term, the government's the government's books take a hit on the deficit side because you are losing income from the assets you've sold, and you're waiting for the new assets to come on stream in terms of new revenue. The best assumption that I believe I can make is that those new assets eventually give us revenue at the same rate as the assets that you sold. So in the numbers, if the dividend yield on the old assets was 8%, I'm assuming that eventually the new school buildings or the new roads or the new broadband gives us about an equivalent of an 8% return, except it'll be through taxes rather than dividends. If that happens, and I believe that's the best case scenario, then the blue bars go back to the black bars, but over the long term. But you've still got a short-term hit on the government's accounts. The brown bars are the option of borrowing domestically. And borrowing domestically, yes, you take a hit in the short term, but not by as much as the asset sale, because you're still retaining the old assets. And over the long term, you get a permanent improvement in the government's deficit. That is compared to the baseline. And that is because you're reaping the income from the newly constructed assets in terms of tax revenue, and you're still getting the income from the assets, the old assets that you retained. So that's those pictures in words, and I'll shoot through the words. They're there for you in the pack. The impact of those previous two slides on the net worth, that is the balance between assets and liabilities, or assets and borrowing, to keep it very simple, is one of the government's deficit is getting worse in the short term, then the net worth is run down, because the worst deficit has to be funded through some form. We assume some cash reserves get run down, some non-yielding assets. We didn't want to make the story too complicated. But the important thing is that net worth reduction is sustained over the long term, because you never actually ever recoup that short-term loss in income. Even under the best assumption that the new assets give us the same level of income as the previous old assets that we've sold off, because you still have to wait for them to come on stream. Under the brown bars, under the domestic borrowing option, because you take a short-term hit, yes, the government's net worth, even under the brown bars, is worse than the black bars, but it's better than the blue ones. And over the long term, it's even better than the baseline, assuming that those new assets do deliver the same return as those old assets over the long term. That's probably an optimistic assumption, but I don't want to be accused of screwing the scrum against the rebalancing of the assets on the government's balance sheet. In terms of, and so that's in words, the short-term impact is permanent in terms of net worth, because you never recoup those, or however long you have to wait, whether it's 2 years or 5 years, or for school buildings, maybe 15 years. The domestic borrowing option is more favourable in terms of assets and net worth over the long term. In terms of government debt, and this is the important thing, in terms of government debt, because in the blue line, in terms of the asset sale option, because the government's deficit takes a hit, then therefore the government's debt also takes a hit. The debt as a ratio of assets, even though the total stock of debt hasn't changed, they're not borrowing any more in this option, their deficit is worse, that means there's a rundown in assets. That means debt-to-asset ratio rises, and that's sustained over the long term, compared to the baseline. The domestic borrowing option, well, undoubtedly, because we're doing borrowing to fund those new assets, the debt-to-asset ratio rises even more under that option. So the asset sale option, government debt ratio is worse than baseline, permanently. In the domestic borrowing option, government debt ratio is also worse than the baseline. Finally, though, I'd like to move to beyond the government's accounts. and reinforce this difference between external and government. And we've got to start understanding how we should be using our debt, how we should be managing our debt. Just like in the private business sector, debt can be good depending on how you use it. Almost all corporates will have some debt on their balance sheets. Debt is not bad ipso facto. It depends what you're using it for, and it depends in the national perspective, it depends what type of debt that is. Government debt may be good if we're using it for productive assets, whether it be infrastructure, roads, school buildings, broadband, whatever, assuming that it then delivers a bigger economy and more tax returns. Or it could be bad if we're going to the loan shark to tide us over. External debt is the loan shark, and there's no two ways about that. That's just bad. And that's the bottom line that we should be focusing on. The impact of the government's asset sale program is potentially bad on the external debt because of the proportion of assets that will inevitably, unless there are some very stringent rules in place, will inevitably end up in some foreign investors' hands. Whatever proportion that may be, we don't know, so we can't magnify, we can't estimate that proportion. But as long as it's greater than zero, then there will be a negative impact on external deficit, and so therefore on external debt. It's not just me that has this focus on external debt. The government itself has recognised it as our biggest single vulnerability, the largest single vulnerability, as quoted in the budget speech of 2010. So the impact on external debt, it may be positive if we can be convinced that this asset sale program or this rejigging of the assets on the government's balance sheet will inevitably go through to the export sector. I haven't seen any arguments that it will. I'm waiting for that to come out to convince me otherwise. If not, I would say it's a high-risk option to put potentially even more debt on our external accounts without any guarantee that we're going to get any more external income. The domestic borrowing option, the so-called mom-and-pop investors, why sell them a share in the, why sell them an equity stake on assets? Why not just sell them a debt instrument? Term deposits, there's $100 billion of term deposits that our mom-and-pop investors have in trading banks in New Zealand. Why not get some of them to lend directly to government at a competitive interest rate, but it will still be less than that dividend yield? My last conclusion, I think it's very, very risky to go down a route that puts even more pressure on our biggest single vulnerability without some solid, robust evidence that this route is going to benefit our ability to generate export income. That's the bottom line. I can be convinced if there is some good solid evidence that this program is going to give us some export revenues. If not, it's a very unwise route to take. And I leave you with something that underpins the key thing that we should all be focused on. It's not the government debt, it's not the government deficit, it's the external debt, the external deficit, and so therefore our ability to earn external income, i.e. export income. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you, Ganesh. What I suggest is if you want to just come up here and we'll stay here, and we're very happy to take questions.
I have a question about Ganesh about the external debt issue. Do you accept that there's an opportunity cost in terms of not selling these assets that would include a higher level of external debt, and that so why is it necessarily positive for the external debt level not to sell these assets, if instead the government has to borrow more money and a fairly significant proportion of that extra borrowing will be to foreign lenders? Won't that also make the external debt?
There is, if that's the only option available to government, that is going to foreign lenders, then yes, that's a significant risk. But what I put in front of you is that there is another option. That is to go to the New Zealand public.
Yes, but isn't the current account deficit also a measure of the difference between domestic investment and domestic savings? As long as we have a shortfall of savings there, we're going to have to tap international capital markets for the difference. So, is there enough domestic credit available?
There's $100 billion of term deposits there sitting in retail banks, the majority of which goes through to funding property. We need to divert some of that. That's part of the rebalancing. We need to divert some of that into productive economy enterprises, productive infrastructure. We can hope for the New Zealand banks to do that for us, or we could get the government doing it directly.
So you've got, and I'd also say, I mean, just briefly on that, I mean, that, remember that the fiscal position that the government's got itself in is partly a result of some of the decisions that they've made. So the decision around the 2010 tax switch, the decision around the roads of national significance, the ETS, and a number of other decisions. So the fiscal position they're in is to some degree of their own making.
Just one other thing, if I may, sir. In terms, let's assume that the government wants to spend what it wants to spend on other assets. Its options are not just to the two you mentioned. Mm-hmm. It can also raise taxes or cut mm-hmm. other forms of spending. I mean, what yep. do you say about those?
Well, those are other options in front of us, yes. I know, I think those are the options that need to be put in front of the New Zealand public. In terms of economic consequences or in terms of economic philosophy, if we're building new assets, then it is entirely robust and prudent to go down the borrowing route. You borrow to build new assets that are going to give you income into the future. The question that we've got to face is, can we borrow more and where from? And I would argue definitely not from external sources. So that leaves us with borrowing from within the family.
Isn't there a limit to how much those SOEs can gear up with debt in order to boost their overseas earnings to improve that external position? Isn't there a limit to how much debt they can actually take on?
That's the SOEs, but we're not talking about debt for SOEs.
But if we were, they're not highly geared. I mean, as a result of the asset swap in the Waitaki system, there was some increase in gearing within the sector, but they're still pretty low. They have low gearing compared to most other private corporations.
Yeah. Yields are really low on bonds at the moment. No one wants to play the Kiwi earthquake bond because the yield is too low. How are you going to get domestic investors to go into bonds and help the government versus buying into property where the yield is much higher or into equities?
Well, again, there's $100 billion sitting in term deposits, which is only a yield of, 4.5%?
But the two-year bond, correct me if I'm wrong, is about 2.4 at the moment or something? So 4.5 for a 12-month and a term deposit versus 2.5% makes sense to put with your term deposit.
Well, they do have to be attractive where the government gets to put out an attractive offer.
So then what
the Kiwi bond was at 2%,
but the two-year bond on the market at the moment, so the 2013, mm-hmm. I think it's trading at about 2%.
But from the point of mum and pop investors, what they're looking for is something safe. They don't necessarily want to play the share market. That may not be something they've ever done before. And so if it's a comparable rate of return to what they might get in the bank, then actually I think it would be an attractive option for a lot of small-scale retail investors.
So it was a grim policy now.
So in terms of what we've said from the beginning is that if the if you want the SOEs to raise more capital, the government's always said, well, you have to partially privatise them to raise more capital, so they'll issue more shares, because remember, they weren't getting any of the money from the privatisation process itself. They were only going to be given the option of issuing more shares after the government's done it. So what we're saying is the alternative is to issue bonds. So those companies currently do. I mean, it's not a strange thing to do. Those companies could issue bonds to raise the capital they need. And that's a much better option because it's a debt instrument. You don't lose equity control.
So, Ganesh, do you assume, in response to Lucy's question, would you assume in your domestic borrowing option then that the government bonds would be at a rate comparable to term deposit rates?
Yes, I do assume.
Page 22, where you factor in the interest costs, are you factoring in at like 4.5%?
At about 4%, yes. About 4%. It's the same, assuming it's the same as the current borrowing rate. Okay, well, compared to the baseline anyway.
But not term deposit, because obviously if it's a 10-year borrowing option, that's a 10-year bond, that would be much higher.
Yeah. But again, the limits are You could have an interest rate that's higher than the 4.5 if you want to attract even more. The limit is the yield that you're getting back on those new assets.
So if you're having to increase the yield, though, then how does it compare to your dividend?
Well, exactly. I mean, the assumption in the numbers is a dividend yield of 8%. So in the hypothetical accounts we've got, the conclusions would still hold if the government was borrowing at anything under 8%.
But those deposits don't just fund property investment, they fund business lending.
Some of them do. The majority is property.
But if those deposits are shifted from term deposits into government debt, where are the banks going to fund their lending from?
And won't it be offshore?
Well, that's calling in a whole new ball game, in which case we need to look more closely at the regulation of the New Zealand trading banks. I mean, there's no easy answers in this, and there's no easy solutions, and we're talking about a rebalancing of the New Zealand economy. The government has talked about it. It's talked about it for a long time. Those are the key tasks of rebalancing that we have to have.
Doesn't this get back to the point that Brian made before about the lack of savings in New Zealand?
Yes.
There's simply not enough money there domestically to fund the government borrowing and the private sector.
Well, I would argue the lack of savings is also related to the lack of savings vehicles. Is this not just another vehicle to entice even more savings? I mean, some of it will be attracted out of the current savings into trading banks at the moment, but you're looking at a new vehicle. And then I would add that the Christchurch earthquake bonds was a very poorly designed vehicle and that it wasn't attractive. But there was the opportunity. You call them national development bonds, you call them infrastructure bonds, but rather than getting a piece of paper that says you own 0.00% of Meridian Energy or whatever it might be, why don't you get a piece of paper that says you have lent the government X thousand dollars and we will pay you X percent and this is going to help you build, this is going to help your community build a school or build the new road or the broadband. Fly the flag if you like, but it's got to be attractive. Those are the options in front of us, or we have to go to the loan shark.
I mean, when you think about it, I mean, you're comparing, obviously the government's proposal is to raise $6 billion, let's say, $5 to $7 billion. That's going to come from somewhere. A certain proportion of it, they're arguing a very large proportion of it, is going to come from domestic savings somewhere or other. So the government themselves are arguing that a big proportion of that's going to come domestically.
Yes, it's those mom and pop investors. So presumably they're out there, otherwise there wouldn't be a market for this asset sale. My suggestion limits the ability for those assets, for the equity share, to then get leaked offshore through a debt instrument which is not tradable, like a term deposit account.
Dr. Norman, do you not think taking billions and billions of dollars out of the economy in new taxes would have significantly greater effect on the economy than the partial asset sales program?
Well, I mean, if you look at the kind of fiscal decision section of what we're presenting, some of it's what we did in the election campaign, obviously, it's both looking at revenue and spending. So we've looked at some new revenue measures, which we think are important, but it's also looked at spending cuts where we think there's poor quality spending happening. Now, you know, how do you get the right balance? So, you know, Christine Lagarde, you know, the head of the IMF, in her most recent paper said, how do we find our way through the particular position we're in? It's going to be a combination of trying to do the right thing to get our fiscal position back in balance, it's going to be a combination of revenue and spending cuts. I mean, that's a pretty orthodox position. So we've looked at both sides. Where are the revenue options for New Zealand, which also have positive rebalancing effects? Because I think that needs to be taken into account. And where are the spending cuts that we can make which also have positive rebalancing effects? So that's why we focused on ETS subsidies and the roads of national significance in terms of spending cuts, and why we focused on a capital gains tax and a commercial price on water and a carbon price in terms of the revenue gains. I think that you do need to look at both sides of the equation. You can't just look at spending cuts. You also do need to look at revenue. Now, the government, when they introduced the 2010 tax changes, they said they were going to be fiscally neutral. But of course they weren't, so it was revenue negative. So they're doing the wrong thing, the wrong kind of prescription. Nobody knows what is the Goldilocks point for, you know, between spending and revenue, looking at both sides, so that we do increase fiscal resilience while also maintaining demand within the economy. But it definitely involves looking at both sides. It can't just be one side. And the government currently is very much focused on one side. All right. thank you very much. I appreciate you coming along, and enjoy Budget Week. Thanks, Kevin.